Today's podcast sponsor is Smoovie. Smoovie is a portable blender that empowers people to live healthier anywhere, anytime.
You're listening to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast, where we teach you everything you need to know about adopting a plant-based diet, full or part-time. Our goal is to empower you to live a long and healthy life. You can find today's show at ordinaryvegan.net or on iTunes. If you have any questions, please send an email to questions at ordinaryvegan.net.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast number 83, Socially Responsible Investing, also known as SRI, for a Green Planet, with Stephen Kirby, who is the author of the book, You Are the Change, A Beginner's Guide to Socially Responsible Investing. According to Pew Research, two-thirds of U.S. adults say the federal government is doing too little to reduce the effects of global climate change. These findings come amid ongoing efforts by our government here in the United States to roll back regulations designed to protect the environment. This situation can feel very hopeless, but there are things we can do to affect the bottom line of companies who are disrespecting our planet for their own profit. And that includes where and how we spend our money and any investments we might be making now or in the future. I invited Stephen to talk about socially responsible investing because he is a fellow vegan himself, and he is an expert on the topic of the effects of animal agriculture on the environment and vegan investing. Bottom line, his core values align with ours. If we haven't met, my name is Nancy Montori, and I am the founder of this podcast, Ordinary Vegan, the website, and the easy five-ingredient vegan cookbook. I advocate a plant-based diet for health and wellness, for the planet, and for animal welfare. So welcome if this is your first time here. Before we begin our conversation with Stephen, I would like to thank today's podcast sponsor, Smoovie. Smoovie empowers people to live healthier anywhere, anytime, because Smoovie is a new innovative product in the health tech space. Its unique two-piece design and USB rechargeable battery allows you to use it at work, at the gym, at home, or on the road. The battery gives it 20 blends per charge, which is quite a lot, by the way. Oh, and it's the easiest to clean blender on the market. Just add water, a drop of soap, and blend and wash in 30 seconds. Enjoy fresh fruit smoothies packed with antioxidants, vitamins, and extra greens in minutes. Just go to smoovii.com and use the code ordinaryvegan20 and get 20% off your smoothie portable blender. Now, let's welcome Stephen Kirby to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast. Hi, Stephen, and thank you so much for being here today and sharing your knowledge about how we can align our values with our money. Your book is called You Are the Change, A Beginner's Guide to Socially Responsible Investing. So, welcome.
Thank you for having me, ma'am.
My first question is, what is socially responsible investing?
It's a great question, and that's evolved over the last 20, 30 years, so to speak, really since the beginning of time, but really we've seen a dramatic change in the last decade. But by definition, social responsible investing is any strategy that seeks to consider both financial return, yes, financial return, as well as social and environment are good to bring about positive change in society as a whole, right? So that's the definition of it. Essentially, though, what it is trying to create there's multiple forms of social responsible investing, but the form that I think we're going to spend the most time in is creating or finding ways to invest and make money doing that, but also have an impact.
What motivated you to specialize in socially responsible investing?
Oh boy, that's a great question. And it was a game changer, to be honest. About 3 years ago, I watched a movie like probably many current vegans, and it blew my mind on where our food was coming from, the process of our food. And I made an instant decision then that I was going to cut out meat and give the veganism a try. I didn't take much to convince my wife. I showed her the same movie. She said, let's do it. At that stage, she was pregnant. I've been in the financial industry for 15 years at that stage. And it just opened my eyes up to what was going on. So one day it hit us. We're at the grocery store. We're putting our groceries in the cart. We're getting up to the register. You know, we're buying. I'm thinking, oh, you did a great job. You know, we didn't buy any meat, eggs, milk. We're not buying or supporting any of these companies. But then reality hits me on Monday as I go in and I'm looking at my retirement accounts, my 401ks or other clients' investments. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. Tyson's Chicken doesn't care if I don't buy chicken from the supermarket for the most part, because on Monday I'm investing in their company. Therefore, I'm an owner of their company, supporting their company and making them more profitable. And once that reality or that veil became was removed, it I had no choice, because again, as just for me, particularly as far as veganism concerned, there's other social issues that we're going to talk about. For me, that was the driving issue at that stage. I thought the thought of, boy, I'm trying to do good, but I'm not, because I'm making up and creating more damage by my investing. So we had to make a change at that stage, and that's what prompted it.
What movie was it that you watched?
You Are the Health.
Oh, okay.
That one?
Yeah.
Oh, no, excuse me. What the Health.
What the Health, yes. I thought it was that or Cowspiracy. You know, one of those two always creates a big change in people.
It was interesting because at this stage, we were in New Hampshire at the stage, and we were moving to the Midwest to be closer to our family. And we had watched it, and we're literally packing our house, and I could be a little, I'm an all in guy sometimes. So we were all in, and we were starving. We felt like we were starving because we just didn't know what to eat. And then we ended up moving cross country. And as we're driving across the state or across the country, it's a 5 day drive with a 1 year old. We kept listening to more movies like Cowspiracy and some of the others. And by the time we got to Iowa, we were thinking, can you eat anything anymore? But you're right. More and more people I talk to, it's one of those two movies that usually create some action.
2020 has been extremely volatile and troubled times, and people are scared. And according to the book, The Laws of Wealth, the time of maximum pessimism is the best time to buy, and the time of maximum optimism is the best time to sell. Do you agree with that? And is this really a good time to invest in anything?
Yeah, no, I agree with that in principle, right? And so I'll throw the caveat out there is somebody, again, author and financial advisor. I'll put my financial advisor hat on and just say, again, this is broad stroke. So don't take my advice and run off and start buying stocks today. But in general, absolutely. I mean, you know, Warren Buffett had a similar expression. He goes, when people get fearful, I get greedy. When people get greedy, I get fearful. And it's a pretty common theme. By the time investors or clients are calling me and saying, hey, I want in, it's usually the end has already happened, right? It's already passed. And I tell clients that all the time. Usually by the time you're coming to me with this news, the market's already taken it into consideration. But this year particularly is a phenomenal example. I mean, just a particular stock, I'll say Delta Airlines. I'll just throw that one out there. Again, not a recommendation to buy or sell. Just saying Delta, prior to COVID, it was trading at $65. During COVID, it's trading at $25 or $26. So you have to ask yourself, is that company only worth 35% of where it was? And is it going to be there for the long term? Or the market as a whole was down 30%. Does that seem like a good opportunity to get in? To me, it was. So in this particular year, I felt absolutely that, again, that analogy of when people start fleeing the markets, I want to enter the markets.
Most of the people listening to this podcast know that financial planning can reduce so much stress about money. But how does the average person who doesn't have a lot of extra money make a financial plan, and what age should you start?
Yeah, I don't think you're ever too, I mean, it's a silly response probably. It's never too young to start. But I think once you start having financial responsibilities, whatever age that is, it makes sense to understand what you're doing with your wealth, what's coming in and what's going out. That's how business is successful. And I always tell folks that the objective is a good financial advisor, and even if you're your own financial advisor, is to help you run your personal finances like a business. What's coming in, what's going out, and where is it going, and where should your resources be allocated? There's lots of really good free financial planning software out there for younger folks that are just starting off. Again, there's so many. The option of the amount of tools out there right now for free or for very low cost is just outstanding than when I started in the industry. So again, I think as a young person, single, married, just starting off, whatever, maybe you should start with a sort of plan. What is that plan? And that's usually basics for some folks. It could be paying off debt. It could be saving for the first home, first car. Maybe you have a newborn in the house. What are those costs going to look like? What's child education costs going to look like? So planning to me really, and again, when people think financial planning, I think too many people think that's directly at retirement planning. That's a portion of planning, but we're also talking, like as I mentioned, you need cash reserves. That's a perfect example of this year that I could see there's been a failure of financial advisors, and will throw me in there as well, but all of us and individuals as well, the fact that a month after COVID, everybody was broke shows us that most people aren't even following the first law of financial planning. That's creating a cash reserve or an emergency fund, right? So even corporations we're seeing going belly up within a month. It means that there was some poor planning, or they just didn't have the resources for that. So there's a great starting point, a cash reserve. It fits into what's happening this year. Have an emergency fund. So if you lose your job or you're unable to work or unable to make the income that you're accustomed to, that you've got some sort of backup. If you're older, absolutely. It could be different goals. It could be paying off debt, which I'm a huge fan of. Or it could be retirement planning. But I find it interesting, and this isn't to pick on anybody, but I hope it motivates people. You think about it. We go to work every day. You know, hopefully we enjoy our jobs, right? But most people are going to work every day trying to work towards this goal of retirement. But if you ask them, well, how much do you need? How long do you have to go? How much is that going to provide for you in retirement? Are you going to run out of money? Have you looked at inflation? They couldn't tell you. When else in our lives, on anything in our lives, have we just gone and done something through the emotions like that for 30 years with no idea on the end result? It doesn't make sense to us. But again, I think it's a couple of things. One, people don't want to take the time to do it. We're not being educated on it, which is a huge issue of mine. Next book is called What We Should Have Learned in School, right? I mean, we learned a lot of things that we can Google search, but nobody's learned how to pay off mortgages, credit card debts, invest, save, should be taught right out of the gate. But again, most people just don't know what that retirement plan is. So longer answer than I'm sure you were looking for, but I do. I think it's important. You have to know what you're trying to build. If you're building a house, you just don't start hammering wood together. What are you trying to build? Let's create a detailed plan of that build and then put it together in a efficient manner.
Is there a certain percentage of your income you should keep in a cash reserve? Has that changed since COVID-19?
You know, it. There's so many different opinions on it. I've always gone with the 3 to 6 months. I think with the access to credit and equity and some other things that hopefully you don't have to get into, but you know, obviously if you need to, you can. Retirement assets, et cetera, but to me, minimum you'd want 3 months. And I think that the COVID's kind of shown that 3 months is a realistic window. 6 months is pretty much the old school rule that I think is still relevant today. So, and there's no wrong answer, especially if you design your cash reserve properly. I mean, if you're looking at what you're making in the bank today, it's minimum anyway. So there's ways to structure a cash reserve where it's just not sitting in a savings account. If you had an emergency tomorrow, you don't usually need all of your cash reserve or 6 months worth of income. So you can stagger it where some sitting in cash, maybe some sitting in some CDs, maybe some sitting in some bonds, et cetera, et cetera. So you're still able to grow your assets to some degree while you're sitting on them. But cash reserves, again, not just for the emergency, but as you mentioned, the market's down 30%. Well, if you were sitting on cash, you had an opportunity to take advantage of that market that's now recovered 25%. So it's not just for emergencies, but also opportunities.
Is it hard to find socially responsible companies to invest in, since corporate transparency can be shady? Are there any tools that we can use to find these companies?
Yeah, that's the game, right? So that's what this whole concept of social responsible investing is trying to find those companies. What we're able to use right now is something called an ESG filter. It stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance Filter. And different organizations like Sustainalytics, MSCI, Morningstar, and other mutual fund or stock evaluation type companies have created this tool. And what they're essentially doing is gathering as much information as they can through resources online. And they're also sending questionnaires to these corporations and trying to get feedback and information on how they're managing certain areas of the environment, social, and governance. And they're taking this information and giving these companies a score. Well, this started off slow. As you imagine, corporations aren't interested in telling you their gender diversity on their board of directors, CEO pay, and some of these other issues. So it's taken a while. But what's happening in these companies that are getting lower ranks, less people are investing in them. So a good way for somebody, if you're looking at individual equities, you can use something called an ESG, again, the Environmental Social Governance Score, to really see how that company is behaving in those different areas. How's it behaving as it relates to the environment? How's it relating, performing as it relates to how it treats employees? What's the diversity on its board? And it will give it a ranking. And you can compare it against other groups in its category. For example, you're looking for a shoe company, hypothetically. Well, great, here's the 15 top shoe companies and here's how they would all relate to each other in these different areas. So again, that's free information you could find on groups such as Morningstar and Yahoo Finance, I even think has an ESG filter now at the end of your options.
So you can find that online on Morningstar, did you say?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Morningstar is a great resource. And again, for the average person listening right now, if you go to Yahoo Finance and you type in a company, let's say Tesla, for example, at the end of it, it should give you a ESG score on and a sustainability score. And again, it will usually show you other companies in this category that it's competing against. And then you get a good idea of what's happening in that area. And it's one of the ways that you do social responsible investing in the way of these ESG scores, just to kind of give it a quick explanation, is so as an advisor looking for social responsible investing companies, right? So first off, I want to find good companies. That's the whole basis of social responsible investing. And we talked about at the beginning was, you know, consider both financial return and social good, right? So we're not trying to find companies just because they're doing good that are terrible companies. So you start with finding great companies, and then you run them through this ESG filter. And again, all that's doing is pointing out areas of opportunity or risk that this company may be taking. They've been fined by, environmental groups 15 times for this, or they've been known because they've had multiple complaints against them in this area. So you can see that information, and that information is where these scores come from, and because that score is dictating a risk. And again, in the book, I utilize BP as an example. Everybody's familiar with the BP oil spill. Well, as an ESG investor, we were out of that years before because the amount of complaints and the amount of fines, the amount of issues that were pointed to it didn't tell us that there would be a massive oil spill, but showed us that there was too much risk as it related to its return. So yes, ESG can be found on Yahoo Finance, and I think they started doing it with mutual funds as well, which is pretty interesting.
And they even asked the question about gender diversity, did you say? Is that one of the questions on the questionnaire to these companies?
You got it. It's one of the major players to me is, again, one of the funds that we manage is environmental, vegan, and gender equality. What we know historically, just based on the data and the research, and it makes sense that companies that have more than three women on a board of directors, those companies perform better. When you have women in CEO roles of higher roles in a company, historically we're seeing that those are having better performance in the market as performance as companies. And it makes sense. The problem right now is you look at a lot of these old companies, I call it the old boy network. You know, it's dad and his cronies and a bunch of the other buddies that all kind of agree on with each other. That's not a good way to run a company. I want to be able to toss a problem in the middle of the table and have multiple perspectives look at that problem and say, hey, here's how we should handle it. That's how you become diverse as a company, and it's through diversity on your board of directors in positions of power. So, yeah, that's a huge piece.
That's great.
As a matter of fact, it's a standard in Europe, in a lot of places in Europe, to make sure that you have at least three women on the board of directors.
That's great to know. Do companies with higher overall ESG ratings have lower earnings?
Absolutely. There's a lot of data. And again, the data is still pretty fresh over the last 5 to 7 years. I think it's become strong. But again, we can spend an hour just on the different research reports, but one of the most simplest one is Deutsche Bank did it, is 2,000 different research. They looked at 2,000 different research projects, and what they came back with is they know that in 90% of companies that use ESG matrix based on this research had a better financial return. And it just makes sense. It just makes sense. So the beauty of that is now as you see more and more people moving in that direction, it's going to increase. So the companies get more and more pressure to answer these questions that they don't want to answer, because more and more groups are asking them and putting the pressure on it. If they're not answering these questions, if they're not participating, they get a lower rating, which is now having a significantly larger impact on them, which is the goal.
What are the best ESG companies?
That's a tricky question.
I knew it was going to be, but I was just curious.
Yeah, well, I can give you the best ESG companies. Well, again, when you're looking at ESG companies, it's really going to be based on it's going to be based on the category, right? So if I'm looking at car manufacturers, et cetera, et cetera, I'll tell you some that I have in my portfolio, right? Now, again, I'm not saying buy these. I'm just saying these are some that I follow that I'm very comfortable with that I would give high ESG ratings. And folk could put it for what it's worth. But to me, what I'm looking at specifically, and that's what I'm saying, there's 500 stocks just on the S&P 500. There's thousands of stocks. So which are the best ones? For me, what I'm looking at is I try to take all those, narrow it down to 30 to 35, and then I cross-check that against gender equality. If you don't have two women on the board of directors, I dump you as a stock. If your median salary isn't in alignment with CEO pay, I dump you as a stock. And if you don't reach our vegan threshold, which is the biggest part of, and the exciting part of this conversation is, again, how do you have vegan portfolios? That's a new concept right now. But for me right now, some of the best groups with ESG scores are financial groups, TD Ameritrade, Bank United. Intel's a simple one. Cummins, which I mentioned in the book, a large industrial manufacturing group. I like groups like Southwest, F5 Networks, which you're talking about, G5. So again, it just depends. But if somebody's interested in a specific category, let's say software, again, they can go to a Yahoo Finance, type something in like an Intel, and it's going to compare all the other groups in that technology field or that industrial field against each other and show you which ones have the highest ESG score. So it really depends on what category you're trying to find.
So what are the steps that we need to follow to create a socially responsible investment plan? And how would we begin? And especially if we just have a small amount of money.
Okay, there's a couple different ways, and I'll try to be brief with it. One, again, understand that I'm gonna lead it broadly, but I'll also keep zeroing it back to the veganism, because that's just a passion of mine, and that's a specialty area that we're trying to encourage more and more people to start considering.
As we are too.
Yeah, and that's the problem. So as I go through this process, you'll see the one flaw in it for folks like ourselves that are looking to create these compassionate portfolios, so to speak. Again, from a financial planning standpoint, I'll go through the simple processes. The first process is just create a plan. What are you trying to create? What are you trying to build? And we discussed that earlier. Is it paying for a home? Is it saving for kids' education? Saving for retirement? What are we trying to build, so to speak? And what this does is gives us the information we need. Let's say it is retirement. Retirement's 30 years out. Well, how much do I make today? How much do I need? So it gives us some numbers, and it gives us an idea on what we need to grow our assets at to get to that, right? So let's say, because these old adages are like, well, as you get near to retirement, you should be more conservative. Well, not necessarily so. If you're behind in retirement, being conservative could guarantee that you don't have enough. And if you're young, you should be aggressive. Well, not necessarily. Maybe you're a millionaire and you're young. You don't need to be. So those old adages don't make sense. The point is, what is the goal? That gives us an idea of what type of rate of return we need to target to get there. Those are the two easy steps. Once you get that, you say, okay, I know I should be a moderate investor, a moderate aggressive investor. Okay. And these are some of the steps that you can go through with an advisor. And again, not trying to push people to the book, but I outline it pretty easily in the book, and it's less wordy than me explaining it, obviously. But once you create this asset allocation model, it's what most folks are familiar with, the pie chart. And it talks about large cap, mid cap, small cap. Again, how do you create a portfolio that's actually has true diversity, right? I can meet a client that has Southwest, Delta, American Airlines, and Frontier Airlines and say, I've got a diverse portfolio. Well, no, you don't. You've got four companies, but they're all airlines. So again, how do you create true diversity? And once you know that, So once you get that, that's when we've got the foundation of what we're trying to build. You know what type of rate of return you need to get. So you know what type of model you need. So let's say your risk tolerance is moderate. So I'm moderate. That means I want a little bit of bonds and I want a little bit of stocks. Excellent. Now, how do we use that information to become a social responsible investor? There's a couple ways of doing it. So let's say you have a small amount of money. A very simple way is just buy what we call a target date or a risk or an asset allocation model. Okay, what that is just a mutual fund that is really based on your risk tolerance. So you say, look, I'm a moderate investor. I want to buy a moderate portfolio. And what they've done in one mutual fund, it's like a fund of funds. And that one mutual fund, you can buy that fund and it will be a blend of large cap, mid cap, small cap, bond, internationals, all the different pieces you need. So that's easy. So then you say, okay, I know I need this. I'm a moderate investor. I need a moderate target date fund. Well, how do I become a social responsible investor? Well, that's when you start needing to find a SRI or an ESG related target date fund. And that could be something as easily as a Google search. Okay, so I need a target date fund or an asset allocation fund that's ESG, and you could pull up a list of them. And again, that's where it gets a little bit more convoluted, a little bit more complex. How do you want to research those? And again, I discuss that in the book. You can use groups like the USSIF, where they have a list of social responsible mutual funds, which I love their list, and they'll outline on the top how that fund is created. And what you'll know as vegans, as you go across that list, one of them, the subcategories is animal testing and animal cruelty. And as you scroll through that list of mutual funds, what you'll find is almost none of them screen for that. That means none of those companies really take that into consideration, which means although those funds may look at the environment and governance and some of these other issues, they're not looking at animal welfare or animal rights, which is the biggest issue to me. Yeah, I thought I'd pause there because I can keep going. But
No, that's good information. If you were to hire an advisor, how are they compensated?
That's a tricky one, but it's pretty simple in the same way. So you've got a couple different groups out there. You've got folks that are pure commission based. And again, I don't want to put anybody down or how anybody makes a living. We're all trying to make a living. I'll just outline whether a commission based investor is a transactional. You want to buy something, they'll sell it to you. It's pretty simplistic. It's transactional based. So a lot of the clients I meet come from commission based advisors because once something's been bought or sold, there's not a lot of real incentive to continue to meet that client unless there's the potential to continue to buy or sell something. So for me, that's a model for somebody that just wants a quick transaction. I want to buy one mutual fund and then I'll take care of it myself. Others fee only advisors. So those are folks that charge a flat fee for their service. It could be a couple $1,000s. It could be all over the place, depending on the amount of assets and the complexity. Those folks are more like an attorney. They'll just charge you a fee and they'll create a financial plan for you and then give you a list of investments and then kind of help you with that in that format. And then a fee-based advisor is a hybrid of the two where they can do the financial plan for you. They can send you home with it where you could put it together yourself or implement it yourself, or they could help you with it. In our case, again, I'm mostly fee-based. I charge fees for managing assets because the beauty of that concept versus commission is if you do better, I do better. If you do worse, I do worse. And to me, it just makes sense to have some skin in the game with your advisor. But we also want to be able to you know, keep a line of products open for estate planning that may make some sense. But there's really those three ways of hiring it. I think as people are looking at advisors, it's extremely important that they ask those questions. And the one that doesn't get asked enough is how do you get compensated?
Right. When Beyond Meat went on the stock market, I know a lot of people who never owned stock in the vegan world invested in Beyond Meat stock. And of course, it has done wonderfully. Are there any socially responsible IPOs, initial public offerings like Beyond Meat, on the horizon who might be going public and we should watch out for?
That's a great question. There's nothing hopping out to me right now, but I'd like to continue that. I'll send you that if that's something you want to put on your page and share with investors, because that is a great question. But the areas that I'm interested in following, so I am following sectors as a whole. And I think, and again, I put that down earlier. So a conversation I had with a client earlier, we were talking about the Beyond Meat and what a game changer it is. You know, this Beyond Meat, this impossible meat, what a game changer it was. And again, when that stock was coming out, most clients that I was talking to about had no idea what Beyond Meat was. Now they do, right? The future, I think right now is, and again, this is just my opinion from what I'm watching. I think it's going to be this lab-created meat. So there's a few groups out there. If you Google search right now, they're private equity. So they're only taking private equity. But you've got a lot of big names, that are invested in these, but essentially they're growing meat in a lab. Now to us vegans, the thought of that sounds kind of disgusting, but, if you look at a meat eater, let's say, and they're going to eat, have a hamburger, how much work, money, food, water to create that hamburger. If they can create it in the lab, and when they create it in the lab, it takes almost no resources. It's completely organic. It's as healthy as a piece of meat you can create. So I think that is going to be one of the biggest areas of change that we see moving forward, as in this lab-grown meat, because this COVID has really pointed out the flaws in our food systems. And we're going to start seeing some innovation heading that direction. But that is a great question. Yeah, but there's a lot of what you're going to start seeing is a lot of new groups that actually are private equity groups being bought up by bigger companies. That's a concern of mine. It's pros and cons to it, right? You know, you'll see again these companies that start with these innovative ideas, a larger company will come in and buy it.
Yes.
And make part of their holdings, which I don't love. I understand why that company would do that, but. That's a bigger concern of mine is these little sustainable organizations, these vegan groups starting off right and then getting bought out by the Tyson Chicken and the Smithfields. And
it's happening all the time. My very last question to you is, with transparency in society at an all-time high and the cancel culture has been so effective at making companies accountable for their actions, what is the impact of this on companies in their stock? Can companies like Pepsi and Chevron just keep polluting and destroying our planet and getting away with it? When will it finally affect their bottom line?
I think these conversations, again, I appreciate you having me on. Because of COVID, I've been able to get there and talk. So, you know, I apologize, I've been a little rusty with it, but this is great to have the conversation about it. And that's why it's so important. I'd give the book away to anybody. I want people in this fight. And so I've got a lot of friends. I'm in Iowa. We've got a lot of friends that are out protesting. And that's great. You got to get out there, get some boots on the ground. But you want to change companies. You want to change. You hit them in their pocket. Okay, you know how this game works. It's a bottom line issue. So you can talk and talk and talk and wave signs all you want, but if you're not impacting their bottom line, these companies in many cases aren't going to change. And the problem is the way the system's set up. You've got CEOs and you know, these guys are in, their pay is impacted. They're looked at from a quarterly basis. I can't even balance my family's budget in a quarter. How is somebody supposed to run a company quarter to quarter and always be profitable? It's short-term thinking. So you've put these guys in a predicament. So the whole system is flawed. So how do you change it is what we're talking about. And I use an analogy, you know, these corporations are like these large ships and you've got people on the sideline, you know, throwing bottles at it, waving their signs, they're protesting it. You got other people just trying to get out of the way of it. Like, there's nothing I can do. Let's just get out of the way. Social responsible investing, what we're trying to do here with these conversations is to commandeer that ship. So what we didn't talk about in the book, I hope people look into, is shareholder advocacy. If you own $2,000 worth of a company stock for a year, you can vote. You get to vote for board of directors. So they're going to put another male on the board of directors. There's no females. You have a say in that. How much is this guy getting paid? You have a say in that. So as a shareholder, you own shares of that company. And as a group, we go in and buy companies that we don't even like. So we can go to that company board meeting, Tyson's Chicken, and demand that they start investing in alternative meats. So how do you make change? You hit them in their wallet. And understand that your investments right now, everybody listening to this podcast, or the majority of people, have an investment. It's either in retirement plan, maybe if they're just starting off, it's in a mutual fund. You have voting rights. But again, you dig into it a little bit deeper, understand your voting rights. Most people have voting rights and they're not doing anything with them. So they're being managed by the mutual fund owner and they're voting with the board of directors. So these boards are never going to change. but we have seen change. Dick's Sporting Goods, perfect example, the banning of the assault weapons, right? That's because shareholders stood up and said, no, that's going to hurt the stock. The company's bottom line, we don't support it. They changed it. So it works. It's impactful. It's having changes right now that all your listeners are able to enjoy, and they don't even know why. It's because people out there are working together with these shareholders, which could be you folks listening, to make change. That's how you're going to change. Pickets and signs, I think it's great. Keep protesting. That's excellent. Impact their bottom line, hurt their pocket. You'll see change happen.
Great information. Thank you, Stefan, so much for being here today and sharing your knowledge. The Ordinary Vegan community appreciates it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I'm glad to help.
Bye-bye.
Thanks to Stefan for joining us today. You can find me in this week's podcast notes at ordinaryvegan.net, and I will include a link to Stefan's book and his contact information. Thanks to Smoovie for sponsoring today's podcast. You can find the Ordinary Vegan line of CBD products made from hemp and the Easy 5-Ingredient Vegan Cookbook at ordinaryvegan.net/shop. Oh, by the way, there's an interesting article and study that was published in Forbes magazine last week. And although many, many more studies are needed, experts from the University of Nebraska and the Texas Biomedical Research Institute are recommending that scientists study the anti-inflammatory properties in CBD as a potential treatment for lung inflammation caused by the coronavirus. Because of CBD's potential as an antiviral and its ability to calm down the immune system and reduce the cytokines. I believe it was Dr. Greger who mentioned the connection between cytokine storms and COVID-19. Cytokine storms is an inflammatory immune response that is triggered by COVID-19. And these scientists think there is a possibility that CBD can reduce cytokines and help the lungs recover from the overwhelming inflammation. Like I said, these are early studies, and this isn't guaranteed yet, but wouldn't it be great if there was an all-natural, sustainable plant like CBD from hemp that could reduce deadly lung inflammation from COVID-19? I will put a link to the study in this week's show notes. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Please stay safe, stay well, and please stay kind, because we're all struggling, and it's so easy to get overwhelmed these days. Till next time.
Thanks for joining our plant-based community today. Together, we can accomplish great things. Please subscribe so you don't miss any of Ordinary Vegan's recipes and plant-based tips. If you have any questions or feedback, email us at questions@ordinaryvegan.net. Until next time.